All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, you guys, introducing our friend Steven Zunis. He is featured in the new documentary, Worth the Price? Joe Biden and the Launch of the Iraq War. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Great to be with you.
So listen, I've already interviewed you about this before a few months ago or a couple weeks ago or whenever it was. And I already interviewed Matthew Ho, who's featured in this same movie. But I hate Joe Biden. And I also want other people to hate Joe Biden. So would you say everything that you know and think about Joe Biden? That should do it.
Well, to start off with, the big issue that keeps coming up for a lot of us, of course, is the Iraq War. And it's not just the fact that he voted for the war, as unfortunately almost all Republicans and about 40% of Democrats in Congress at the time did. But Biden played a critical role in shepherding the war resolution through the Democratic-controlled Senate. He was then head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And here we have, you know, the most important foreign policy decision of a generation. And he only allowed for a day and a half of hearings. A day and a half of hearings. And obviously, a lot of us wanted to testify. As some of your listeners may know, I was pretty visible at that time. I was on CNN, MSNBC, NPR's Talk of the Nation. God, even on Fox a few times. You know, I was just trying to, you know, get the word out because I knew something about this sort of thing. I mean, before I got my job at the University of San Francisco, I was a senior researcher at the Institute for Global Security Studies. So part of my focus was on non-traditional weapons in the Middle East. So I knew Saddam didn't have all these weapons and weapons programs and weapon systems that Bush and Biden and other people were talking about. And so I wanted to testify. Scott Ritter, former chief weapons inspector, wanted to testify. Phyllis Bennis, the Institute for Policy Studies, wanted to testify. In fact, my senator, Senator Barbara Boxer, actually requested, she was a member of the committee, actually requested to Biden that we be allowed to testify, but he blackballed all of us. And instead, he brought in these really sketchy Iraqi exiles, you know, who understandably, I guess, you know, given they had lived under Saddam Hussein, wanted to get rid of them and, you know, hope to provoke a U.S. invasion that would do that. Spout all this nonsense about, oh, they'd seen stacks of chemical weapons with their own eyes, how, of course, American troops would be, you know, treated as liberators. And Biden, you know, brought in, a whole slew of former Bush administration, people to testify about the supposed great threat Iraq was and how they supposedly had ties to Al-Qaeda. And this kind of nonsense. I mean, the hearings were they're a sham. They were just a total sham. It amazes me that that this is not being brought up more. That he did not just vote for the war, but he didn't just lie about the weapons of mass destruction. He played probably the most critical role outside of the Bush administration itself in making the war possible. I mean, here's a guy who brings in Caspar Weinberger, who insisted was a credible witness despite multiple perjury indictments for lying before Congress and a history of grossly exaggerating the military capabilities of Nicaragua, Cuba, the Soviet Union, other designated enemies of the United States. And he's supposed to be a credible witness to talk about this threat to Iraq. And Ritter, you know, when it was clear that he and the rest of us weren't be able to testify, you know, basically he said the whole hearings were nothing more but a political sham used to invoke a modern day Gulf of Tonkin resolution equivalent to Iraq, you know, And, you know, what's disturbing about this is that I keep hearing these things. Oh, he made a mistake. You know, well, it was worse than a mistake. It was a very deliberate, very conscious policy. And say, well, that was a long time ago. Well, he hasn't owned up to it. In fact, he's repeatedly lied about his role in it. Denying that he said things that he'd clearly said. The guy has not learned his lesson. He's still a threat. And I actually fear that if he became president, he'd trump up another kind of war to get us into for oil or something else.
Yeah. So there's so much to go back over there, but I wanted to emphasize one of the important points that you made there about how the Democrats were in the majority. He was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time. And in that position, if he had really wanted to, he probably could have stopped this war single-handedly. If he, for example, had decided, oh, yeah, well, I'm just going to keep inviting Scott Ritter to testify until this whole project is crashed on the rocks of the truth here. And in fact, could you please do us a favor, especially for people who were not so plugged in back in the 90s and early 2000s and don't know? Can you tell us about Scott Ritter's role? Because in the 90s, he was known as the guy who was constantly accusing Saddam Hussein of blocking their inspections and all these things, and the Hawks were always invoking him.
Oh,
then,
yeah.
When 2002 comes around, he's out there standing athwart history, screaming, stop, at the top of his lungs. And people thought, well, what is with this guy? There's been a big flip-flop here. But he insisted there's no flip-flop. I'm saying the same thing now that I'm saying then, but it seemed pretty strange to people that he had gone from spokesman for the Hawks to spokesman for the Doves. Yeah. So can you untie all that for us?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Scott Ritter, he's a Marine veteran, registered Republican. He was essentially the chief weapons inspector. He wasn't the head of UNSCOM. That was Hans Blix and later Butler. But he was the guy who actually did the stuff on the ground. And he was right. You know, the Iranians were running circles around them, and they got to 90% of the stuff they wanted to look for. But there was definitely a cat and mouse game that was really frustrating. Got people to wonder, you know, what are they really trying to? To hide anything. I mean, we now know that part of it was a bluff because the Iraqis wanted the Iranians to think they might have something, so the Iranians wouldn't take advantage of having been totally disarmed to try anything provocative against them. And also the guy, he was a total germaphobe, and so he didn't want these inspectors tromping around his presidential palaces or whatever. And there are a whole series of reasons that he was doing these evasive maneuvers, but they had nothing to do with him actually having these kind of weapons. Still, of course, you can understand why someone might be suspicious and frustrated, but eventually, Saddam allowed them to do more and more. And if you're ever driven by a chemical weapons or a chemical factory of any kind, these things are massive. You can't really hide these things. Similar with a nuclear plant. You know, these are not things that you can hide. And you know, we had these spy satellites that are powerful enough to read on a license plate on the back of a car. And this is Iraq, you know, where the 340 cloudless days a year, you know. So it's really hard to imagine them actually hiding things.
Right.
And what
had happened was he was just a hawk as hell about that last 5% of old stuff we haven't found yet and that kind of thing. But then when they turned around and said, oh, yeah, they're making sarin, he was like, wait a minute, that's an outright lie. That's a whole other area. So at that point, he turned around, was just as hard on the Republicans as he'd been on the Republican Guard over there.
Exactly. And indeed, you know, even if Saddam had not gotten rid of these weapons from way back, the shelf life of these weapons is only like 3 to 5 years. I mean, they were no longer weapons. Even if you had them, they were not weapons grade material. I mean, you wouldn't want to eat the stuff or anything, but, you know, they were certainly not. threat at that point.
By the way, let me interject here, Stephen. I'm sorry, but this is really important. There's this New York Times story. I'm sure you're familiar with this. There's a New York Times story from, I'm almost certain, 2008 about chemical weapons that were found by American GIs during Iraq War II, how they were exposed, how oftentimes they were sickened, and then the whole thing was covered up. And if anybody has a right-wing Uncle Bob with an email list, then they've seen this story cited as proving that Bush was right all along. And yet, and I hear this, people ask me about this all the time. They really do, even still. And the simple answer is, read the whole article yourself. Don't let somebody tell you what's in it.
Yeah.
Read
yeah,
the actual article, and they make it clear. This is stuff that we, the taxpayer, at Ronald Reagan and George Bush's command, had Bush Sr.'s command, had paid for Saddam to buy from the Europeans back in the 1980s. None of it had been made in the 90s during the inspection period the early 2000s leading up to the war.
These were literally found in a dump. They were in a dump because they were no longer weapons grade.
Yeah, I mean, again, these are old shells, dangerous. Essentially.
Yeah, right. They're dangerous, and that's why our GIs got sick. But again, they were not weapons. They were not useful as weapons. That's why they threw them in a dump. And let me mention, it was not just, you know, they didn't actually, to clarify, they didn't actually buy chemical weapons from the Europeans. What they did was, we were providing them with U.S. taxpayer dollars, pesticides and fertilizers and that kind of thing that could be the deadly material could be extracted from them and used to make chemical weapons. And it was, and congressional hearings in the 1990s show that the United States actually was aware that Saddam was doing this, and yet we kept on providing these fertilizers and pesticides and other raw materials that were critical for making these chemical weapons. And of course, with a super, super strict embargo on, you know, the strictest sanctions in history on Iraq after the Gulf War in 1991, they no longer had access to the raw materials to make chemical weapons. But another thing I should mention about our complicity in this was that during the Iran-Iraq War, we had officials from the Defense Intelligence Agency on the ground in Baghdad downloading U.S. satellite photos of Iranian troop concentrations and passing those on to the Iraqis in the full knowledge that they were using chemical weapons against them.
Yep.
And this is something that the Iranians still talk about to this day, you know, one of the reasons for their fanatic anti-Americanism. When I was in Iran last year, about this time, I actually got to interview some survivors, and they are still in very, very, very bad health impact in terms of what it did to their lungs and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But even putting aside our complicity, you know, and Iraq developed the weapons in the 1980s. By 2002, you know, they absolutely had nothing that could be used against us or against their neighbors or anything like that. They were in no way, shape, or form a threat. And yet here is Biden, as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, kept repeating this. And the thing is that, and his role, it shouldn't be underestimated, because, you know, when people are elected to the Senate or to the House or whatever, nobody's an expert on everything. And so they tend to look at the head of the relevant committee for guidance in areas they don't know much about. You know, so people look at the head of the agriculture committee if they don't know much about agriculture, or they'll look at the head of the Armed Services Committee if they don't know, you know, much about the Pentagon or procurement, things like that. And people will look at the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for guidance on foreign policy. And this is particularly critical since very, very few people run for Senate based on foreign policy issues. It's one of the areas that senators tend to know the least about. And so when the Democrats looked up and said, hey, here's our guy, here's Joe Biden, he's been in Congress for a long, long time, we could trust him. It had an impact in swaying a whole bunch of those votes.
Yeah.
Possibly enough to have made the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now let me ask you something, because there's a clip going around of Biden, and it's when Scott Ritter's testifying in 1998 during the Iraq Liberation. I'm not sure if it's, I think it's during the Iraq Liberation Act debate, or maybe just the debate surrounding Desert Fox and all that something. But anyway, and Biden is saying nothing short of regime change is going to accomplish this. Everybody knows that. And that made me curious about whether back in the 90s, 98 era, especially right around then, how closely he was palling around with Richard Pearl and Ahmed Chalabi and those guys who were pushing for the Bay of Goats option, the invasion and occupation of the South and all of that Chalabi INC stuff back then.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot, not everybody who voted for the Iraq Liberation Act, you know, was wanted invasion. I mean, many of them were basically saying Saddam's a bad guy, good to get rid of him, and, you know, maybe we can fund some opposition groups who will do it. But they were not advocating the United States going to war or anything like that. Biden, however, in those hearings, literally used the words, sooner or later, we're going to need boots on the ground to get rid of Saddam. So he says, we need to get rid of Saddam, and he says, we need boots on the ground to do it. That is a call for an invasion. Okay, so this was before Bush and Cheney came to office. This is before 9/11. So this idea that Biden, like a lot of people, got swept up in the hysteria of 9/11. He naively believed all these things from Bush and Cheney, whatever. No, he was calling for invading Iraq before any of that.
Hey man, you guys are going to love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver, is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. commoditydiscs.com, or just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Hey guys, Scott Horton here for ExpandDesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to ExpandDesigns.com/Scott and save $500. So I want to play this clip. You mentioned about him being a liar, and I'm sorry, this will take about a minute and a half here. This is Biden on MSNBC being interviewed by Lawrence O'Donnell the other day, who, of course, lets him slide on all of this stuff. But this is Biden's version of what was going on back in 2002 and 3 there and his role in it.
Look, the reason I voted the way I did was to try to prevent a war from happening because, remember, the threat was to go to war. The argument was because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. So he said that I need to be able to get the Security Council to agree to send in inspectors to put pressure on Saddam to find out whether or not he's producing nuclear weapons. And at the time, I said, that's your reason. All right, I get it. That was the rationale was that's the way to not go to war, because I didn't believe he had those nuclear weapons. I didn't believe he had those weapons of mass destruction. And you may remember the debates we had after that period about when Colin said, anyway. So that was the rationale. Mm-hmm. What happened was we went in, determined that they hyped what in fact was occurring. They didn't. There was no concrete proof of what he was doing. And they still went to war.
There you go. That's his version of 2002 and 3. Your comments, sir.
It's just stunning that he does. First of all, the International Atomic Energy Agency, in their final report, in their reports in 1998 and 1999, said there is absolutely no evidence that there was anything resembling a nuclear program in Iraq. And again, nuclear facilities are even harder to hide than chemical weapons facilities. I mean, again, you know, so the UN had already come in, already determined this. And there was no way in hell, especially with the, given how serious the sanctions were and everything else, that they could start a nuclear program from scratch in those in the 2.5 years subsequent to the International Atomic Energy Agency's detailed report. Second thing is that Saddam Hussein had agreed for the unconditional return of inspectors 3 weeks prior to the vote. So, and indeed, when you know the United States, of course, and you know, delayed by accepting that because they wanted the United Nations to pass a resolution that said, oh, if any member country believes that they aren't fully complying, that they have a right to take military action, which of course the UN was not willing to do. They did finally pass a very strongly worded resolution in December of that year, saying at 1441, that said, Saddam, you know, let these guys in, let them do their thing, and it'll have very, very, very serious consequences. And if you don't. And the Security Council remains seized of the matter, meaning that, again, no individual country can take action, but it needs to go back to the UN. And the UN would, at that point, many people assumed, would indeed have authorized military force if Saddam had not been cooperating. But he was cooperating. He was cooperating once the inspectors returned. And the thing was, but what Biden kept on doing was that, and this is where some is, more other atrocious lies came in, was that even when the inspectors returned in December, and even though they had been, you know, had totally unrestricted access, they went to every place they wanted to go, no problems. They did not, we were not finding anything. And Bush decided to invade anyway. Biden supported him. Now, recent months, Biden has been lying, saying that, oh, I oppose the actual decision to go to war. But no, he's explicitly, they have him on Face the Nation and Meet the Press and other statements saying, yes, Bush is right to go to war. There's nothing that can be done to stop it. Let's go ahead anyway. And claiming Saddam wasn't cooperating when the UN said he was. He's just rewriting history altogether.
Well, and it's just amazing, right? He's not just lying. He's turned the whole thing completely upside down where, look, I knew there were no weapons. And so I only was trying to get the inspectors in there to disprove the case for war in order to try to stop it. I mean, wow, that's incredible. You know,
he kept saying categorically that Iraq had chemical weapons, that they had biological weapons, that they had a nuclear weapons program, that they had these sophisticated delivery systems, SS-20s, SS-22s, these kind of missiles and things like that. And he even claims that everyone thought Saddam had these weapons of mass destruction. The weapons inspectors said he had them. And the nerve, I mean, no, there are a lot of us, especially those of us who have a background in strategic studies, who are saying, no, they don't happen. And of course, the chief weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, wanted to testify for his committee, who said they didn't have them, and he wouldn't let him.
Well, and all the inspectors on the ground, as you said, were complaining for months. I mean, the war didn't kick off until March, and the inspectors were going, look, we went to every place you told us to go, and there was nothing there. You claim you have all this intelligence, and you know for a fact he's got the stuff. Give us some updated coordinates, and we'll go look there, too. But we looked everywhere there is to look so far and found nothing.
Exactly. Exactly. And despite not finding anything, when Bush was clear he's going to go to war, you know, this is just the 24 hours before the launch of the war, he said, I support the president. Diplomacy over avoiding war is dead. I do not see any alternative. It's not as if we can back away now. Let loose the dogs of war. I'm confident we will win. And then he co-sponsored a resolution supporting Bush in the invasion. Now he's coming back and saying, oh, I didn't support that. I wish we hadn't gone to war. I opposed the launching of the war. And this is the thing. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when I think of the Susan Collins saying, Bush learned his lesson, you know, from the or whatever, you know, on the whole Ukraine deal. And clearly he hadn't. Now, people are saying the same kind of thing about Biden. Oh, he learned his lesson, you know, from his mistake on Iraq. So he wouldn't do anything like that as president. Well, if he'd learned his lesson, he wouldn't be continually lying about it.
Right. Well, and he lies about everything, too, which is kind of a different subject. But yeah, for a guy who, and you know what, there's a Ted Koppel clip from, it's in War Made Easy by Norman Solomon, where Ted Koppel, too, says, let loose the dogs of war. Listen, you can't pretend you were anti-war when you said it like that. You know, some of these people built in weasel words. There's no weasel words in unleash the dogs of war. You're now guilty of genocide. That's all.
Very, very much so. I get it stunning that he's getting away with this. He's been, you know, given a pass on these things, including on a supposedly liberal network like MSNBC. You know, I mean, it's startling the excuses and the rationalizations that I'm hearing from people saying, oh, it was a long time ago. You know, then own up to it. Own up to it.
A long time ago, we're in the middle of Iraq War 3.5 right now.
Exactly.
Two Americans were killed yesterday, and they're blaming it on Iran. I mean, this is not over.
And there would be no American bases in Iraq where Americans would be vulnerable if Biden and the others hadn't pushed this war resolution through. There would be no pro-Iranian militia in Iraq if we hadn't gotten rid of the anti-Iranian Saddam Hussein in our invasion that Biden and the others backed. And so, yeah, it's still very relevant because people are still suffering and dying as a result of this. But, you know, again, the thing is his refusal to own up to it in an honest way. And some people are even making comparisons. Well, you know, people didn't talk about the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in the 1980s. But, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which Johnson used to justify the escalation in Vietnam, that was done with no debate. He pushed that thing in on an August night, and there was no debate and no investigation of the supposed North Vietnamese attacks on the American naval ships or anything like that. And the thing of the Iraq War was there'd been months and months and months and months of debate, and people had plenty of time to think about it. But Biden, stifled the opportunity for senators to hear the debate firsthand.
And plus, people should have been attacked over the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in the 1980s. How can you go along with something with no debate? You didn't get a chance to hear from the captain at all, and you voted for a war that killed a couple of 3 million people?
Exactly.
It makes the Iraq War look like nothing. And by the way, I did say genocide a minute ago, and I know people go, ooh, when only the Holocaust is genocide. Well, actually, you know what? They killed at least 1 million Iraqis. Throw in another 500,000 Syrians, and the rest of the chaos that's going to be in Mesopotamia and the Levant for the rest of our lifetimes. It's not really, it doesn't have to be total mass murder. It's the destruction of a nation is what that means. And this was part of Biden's plan, too. You know what? I screwed up. It's not working. Let's split the country into thirds. But not asking, oh, yeah, but who's going to control the capital city? And what's going to happen to the minority when they're on the losing end of that one? There's your genocide right there.
I
3,000-4,000 dead Sunnis every month for a year and a half as America and the Shiite forces cleanse that city of Sunni Arabs. That's Joe Biden's Save Iraq plan from, phase two. After getting us into it, that's his plan for fixing it.
I wrote about that at the time, actually. And just how dangerous it was. I mean, it was interesting. I pointed out that close to 90% of U.S. Middle East scholars and 80% of State Department Middle East specialists opposed the idea of invading Iraq. So these are across the spectrum. So these are not just leftists and libertarians. We're talking about mainstream liberals, you know, moderates, conservatives, you know, who just knew the region enough to say,
hey, look at Bob Novak on CNN and Pat Buchanan. Anybody who knew anything about it and wasn't just partisan first, that's who was against it.
And they opposed it. But you know, the totals for the and this breakup Iraq in the third into three, that was more like 98% of people because knew that was a bad idea. I mean, even more so, because these kind of divisions generally do not work well, because of course it just entrenches the ethnic and the sectarian identities even stronger, and again, what if you are a minority within this divided thing? Because remember, before the U.S. invasion, Sunnis and Shias intermarried. It wasn't a big deal. If there was a village, only one mosque, Sunnis and Shias worshiped together. I mean, the difference between Sunnis and Shias theologically are even less than they are between Catholics and Protestants. It's not a matter of, oh, Saddam kept the lid on, we got rid of him, these ancient hatreds came out of the woodwork. No, they were not these ancient hatreds. I mean, there were religious wars back in the 8th to 9th centuries.
Just it was a Sunni-dominated state, and we changed that. That's the big deal.
Yeah.
Well, but you're right. As far as the population is concerned, they were all mixed together just like Americans are.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, some areas are more, I mean, just like Germany has more Catholics in the south and more Protestants in the north on average, there's a mixture. And similarly, there are more Sunni areas, more Shia areas, but it's not a clear division that Biden wanted to carve things up in. Mm-hmm. And so these sectarian tensions were a direct impact of the U.S. invasion, where we did this deliberate divide and rule strategy, where we got rid of the two main institutions of secular identity, that is the armed forces and the civil service. And so, which then became fiefdoms of these sectarian groups. When we got rid of the army, I mean, obviously, getting rid of the generals and top people who engaged in war crimes, that kind of thing, that's quite reasonable. But getting rid of everybody in the armed forces, and when starting from scratch, who do we go to? We went to the Badr Corps, which was to form the core of the new Iraqi army, the Badr Corps, which was the armed force of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which was the government in exile recognized by Iran, and the Badr Corps was organized and trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They actually fought on Iran's side during the Iran-Iraq War. So you can imagine all these Iraqis, particularly Sunnis, saying, oh my God, the people who were fought and killed our brethren on behalf of the Persians, our ancient enemies, and who were put in power by the Americans and British, our more modern enemies, and therefore the Shias are part of this conspiracy. So let's go after, some of the more fanatical Sunnis started going after random Shias, and so then the Shias went after random Sunnis, and it was more like Northern Ireland. I mean, Northern Ireland, they weren't fighting over theological issues. They were fighting because historically the Protestants identified with the Unionists and the Catholics, identified with the Irish Republic. And similarly, this was not about a sectarian conflict per se, but because the way the political things aligned, and as thanks to the U.S. invasion. So we are directly responsible. And I say we, meaning the people in the Bush administration, Congress has made this possible, including Biden. And then Biden has the nerve, after creating this sectarian mess, to say, oh, let's just split up the country into three.
Yeah, man. All right. I want to play this clip, too. This is Joe Biden confronted by some Iraq war vets. And, maybe a lot of people have heard this, but maybe you hadn't. And I think it's important to hear the coward Joe Biden hide behind his dead son, because that's all he's got.
I'm an Air Force veteran. I'm an Army veteran. We're just wondering why we should vote for a war and enable thousands of our brothers and sisters. You also give a medal to the man
So there's the coward Joe Biden. He brings up his son, and the guy says, "I'm not bringing up your son." And he says, "Yeah, you better not." Yeah. And then meanwhile, his son actually, he did kill his son in that war. His son, Bo, the one that wasn't a crackhead, he died of brain cancer from the burn pit. And absolutely, Joe Biden did kill his son. But then again, the way he kind of frames it, like, oh, my son died in the war over there. And so that means I paid my price for being wrong about it. I mean, he didn't say that. That was kind of half the implication, maybe, sort of. That, oh yeah, well, something bad happened to me too because of it. And which he didn't even realize. I read a quote where it wasn't until the Burn Pit book came out, and there's a whole chapter about his son in there, that he finally made the connection that he was the one who had given Bo brain cancer. But that's all he's got. Is, you know, the guy says, you're disqualified. You got us into the Iraq war. And he doesn't have anything to say about that other than to just invoke his dead son to hide behind. He can't formulate any other approach to it.
And you know, if you really want to see a difference in attitudes in Biden, about Biden, the division is really clear about those of us who know about Iraq, those of us who remember his role, those who have been impacted by Iraq in terms of losing a loved one, by serving under, serving over there and coming back with physical and psychological struggles. I mean, you know, these are the people who are the most anti-Biden people out there. And you know, here's the crazy irony about saying, oh, getting an anti-war person like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or somebody like that, you know, that Trump can beat. No, it's just the opposite. I mean, in a sense that Trump, ironically, you know, ran to Hillary Clinton's left on foreign policy. He kept bringing up her support for the Iraq war, saying, oh, I opposed it, which isn't true. Trump actually supported it, but he claimed he opposed it. And I will not send your children off to die in overseas wars, America first, bring the troops home, spend our money here, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, he's actually increased the number of troops in the Middle East. He's increased the military spending for overseas wars and that kind of thing. But again, that was the line that he used, and then he used it to great effect. And what's interesting, if you look at the areas that switched most dramatically from supporting the anti-Iraq war, Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, to supporting Bush in 2016, they parallel almost
Trump,
exactly. Trump in 2016. They parallel almost exactly to the areas that had the highest casualty rates from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Yep.
And so by nominating a so-called moderate, because he might be easier to defeat Bush than an anti-establishment, you know, candidate like Sanders. More likely to defeat Trump than an anti-establishment candidate, you know, like Sanders. In fact, it's going to be just the opposite. Yep. It's going to be just the opposite. It's going to not only will traditional anti-war left people stay home, or at least not campaign or contribute, you know, lowering the enthusiasm gap, lowering the turnout, raising the third party vote. But the more kind of, you know, libertarian or more centrist kind of anti-war people who, you know, might sometimes vote Democratic, sometimes vote Republican, depending on who they believe will be less likely to get into war. A lot of those folks who would otherwise vote for someone like Sanders, they're not going to vote for Biden.
Right. I totally agree with that. I mean, the fact that they're running the centrist as the safe candidate is, I mean, that's the same math that they used in 2004 when they put up John Kerry, who lost the same, hell, this is the same thing they did in 2000 with Al Gore. Hillary Clinton in 08 and Hillary Clinton again in 16. And clearly the Americans, if they're going to support anybody at all, the fact that Donald Trump is the president right now is all you need to know that, you know, if the winger is the strong one in the general. In fact, it's funny to see Trump making the same mistake Hillary made about him. And he's doing his own Pied Piper strategy, going out harder after Biden on the assumption that Sanders is the weaker candidate in the general, which is the exact same mistake that the Hillary team made about him. And but he's not that bright, so what the hell?
Yeah, I know there are a lot of Democrats who are you know, desperate enough to get rid of Trump that they'd be willing to support anybody, even when they may have serious disagreements with, if they thought they could, if they thought they had the best chance of defeating Trump. And what's been scary is people I know, Democrats who are definitely on the more anti-interventionist, you know, wing of the party, who are closer to people like Sanders and Warren ideologically, but nevertheless have gone ahead to support a Biden because the mainstream media has kept saying, oh, Biden is more electable. Biden is more electable. Oh, these anti-interventionist, people, or these left-leaning people, these anti-establishment people like Sanders and Warren. Oh, they could never win. If you support them, you're supporting Trump. And you keep hearing this over and over and over again, and people naively believe it. The fact is frankly, I think of all the major candidates running, who were running. Biden, I would argue, is probably the weakest the Democrats could possibly nominate.
Yeah, well, other than maybe Klobuchar. No, I don't know. I mean, and this is the other thing, is they got a severe dearth of talent going on. They tried to run 20 people or something in the primary, and all of
and
them just went
Biden?
Down
I mean,
in flames.
On, you know, just, I mean, just ridiculous.
I know, it is. It's a hell of a thing to watch. But it's good for my guy, Hornberger, so I'm cool with it. But listen, thank you so much for your time on the show, but also just for continuing to be focused on 2002. You're just like me. You just can't get over 2002. I never can. I live that same year over and over again, I know, because of this one issue, right? There's the Iraq war, and lying us into it in super slow motion for a year and a half is just the most incredible thing. And I know that you fought such a good fight back then, and I really appreciate that you're not over it yet and that you're still holding people to account for it. It was not a long time ago. It was not a long time ago. It might as well have been yesterday. And think of the suffering that's still going on in Iraq right now, the suffering of Americans who've been there and back. You know, as Matthew Ho says, this needs to get more, you know, people need to adopt this. People need to talk like this more. I think Matthew Ho really sets a great example. He goes, listen, we're talking about 4,500 combat forces died over there in the war, but just as many contractors also died. Not all mercenaries. Some of them, you know, little old ladies driving trucks and stuff like that. And, and then also the suicides and the veteran suicides. And when you add all that up, 10,000. And that's not including the sacrifice of the Iraqis there. Certainly well over a million by now, by whoever's estimate, dead in this thing. But that's 10,000 Americans died in Iraq War II. I want to act like, oh, yeah, no, that was just, yeah, we probably shouldn't have done Kosovo. Yeah, no, this is not forgivable at all. You know, and
very well said. Very well said,
man. You know, anyway, they're running this guy. He's already won. They don't have anybody else. He's the nominee. That's the occasion of this conversation. I'm tripping. That's great. It's horrible and terrific. And just it's something else, just like everything else right now in this era, I guess. Blows me away.
And but thank you for keeping the issue alive, though, and because, you know, the mainstream media is so busy ignoring it or covering up for it. So we really need people like you more than ever. Yeah, so I really, really appreciate what you're doing here.
Cool. Well, thanks for being somebody for me to talk to here on this show, man. I do appreciate it a lot, Stephen.
Thanks again.
All right, you guys. That is Stephen Zunis. And check out the video, Worth the Price? Joe Biden and the Launch of the Iraq War. The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.